Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
And I'm fucking taking this shit back.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This week, we talk to Raquel Cepeda. Raquel is an author, journalist, filmmaker, podcast host, and a lot more. She grew up in both the Dominican Republic and the New York City of the 1980s. In 2001, she became the editor-in-chief of Russell Simmons' One World magazine. She left the magazine in 2004, just in time to edit the definitive anthology of rap writing, and It Don't Stop, the best American hip-hop journalism. Raquel would go on to make the documentary Bling, A Planet Rock, where she took Paul Wall, Raekwon, and Tego Calderon to Sierra Leone in order to learn the truth behind the diamond trade. Her most recent book is a memoir, Bird of Paradise, How I Became Latina. She's also a co-discussant, as they put it, on the podcast, Our National Conversation About Conversations About Race, along with The Daily Show's head of digital content and author of How to Be Black, Baratunde Thurston, and a guy who's ghostwritten a bunch of books you've read, including Luther Campbell's recent autobiography, Tanner Colby. We talked to Raquel at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you enjoy The Cipher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you'll want to check out episode 124, where we talk to another hip-hop journalist, filmmaker, multi-hyphenate, Sasha Jenkins, who also happens to be Raquel's husband. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. And now, here's our favorite Golden Gloves champ, Raquel Cepeda. About race, there's a big theme on it you keep coming back to, which is something that's come up on the show with like two or three separate guests, which is why I wanted to talk about it. This idea of Black and brown people overcoming collective PTSD from systematic oppression. Right. And there's that. And then this related idea you talk about of toxic stress in children from dealing with the same issues.
And I can see this because toxic stress, one of the responses to being neglected and being subjected to food deserts and prolonged adversity, manifests itself in that way. And this is the way that right now I'm seeing it in my society, in my community, through this depression.
Where did you come up with that framing from?
Well, you know, even before, like there's certain things that I've always felt, but before I could even articulate them, I've felt them. And I've talked about that in my book, Bird of Paradise. You know what I mean? Like something like, for example, being taught that the missionaries that came over to the Caribbean and the New World were all God-fearing and God-loving, and that all the people that were non-white, if you will, were primitive savages. Something didn't feel right about that, right? But I couldn't articulate it. So this is the same thing. I'm always like thinking to myself, you know, people in my community, people of color, we have, you know, black on black crime, black on brown crime, whatever, you know, however you want to configure that.
Yeah.
Self-hatred, this Stockholm syndrome for our colonial masters. Let me just talk about my community and, you know, Dominican Americans, right? And I'm speaking generally. I'm not saying that everybody's that way because then I'm going to have to implicate myself. I don't want to have blue contacts, right? But I've seen it growing up with people who've like anglicized their names. And that's something that we really talk about a lot. And we go back and forth, especially on our last episode of About Race. Yeah. I'm against assimilation. I'm against like, why can't I just be cool? Why can't I just be like myself? Does
well,
it make me differently? Raquel Cepeda.
Yeah.
Raquel Cepeda.
Yeah.
But you could say Raquel Cepeda.
Yeah.
It's still the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe in going like, you know, Rachel, you know, Cepeda, for example. I don't think that that makes me any different or makes me more equipped to play this so-called game, right, with the mainstream. So there's all these things that I've seen people in my community do, you know, straighten their hair to the point where it's like coming out, getting blue contacts, wearing light powder on their skin, you know, doing all these things, right, that they perceive endears them to the man, to our former colonial masters. So that kind of thing, to me, is a form of PTSD. To me, is a form of the how does the, oh, you know, I'm a Gemini, I go on tangents, but it'll all make sense at the end of the day. One day it'll all make sense. So I was just happening to, like, before I was even doing About Race, I was just going online and seeing what was going on in the Caribbean because, I write about travel for the New York Times. And I saw that 14 Caribbean nations were getting together to sue their former colonial masters.
From many distant lands, our forefathers came, some seeking adventure.
In 2013, 14 Caribbean nations under the auspices of the regional organization CARICOM announced that they were suing the governments of the United Kingdom, France, and the Netherlands for reparations for their role in the slave trade. The suits will be brought to the UN's International Court of Justice in The Hague. CARICOM's proposed 10-point action plan includes a full formal apology, psychological rehabilitation, an African knowledge program, and debt cancellation. Incidentally, the music you're hearing in the background is the official theme song for CARICOM.
We vow to join hands and to focus on building one Caribbean. Raise your voice.
And one of the things that they said, and I think it was Jamaica, but I may be wrong, it's one of those Caribbean islands, was that they're suing not only for an official apology for the transatlantic slave trade, but also for post-traumatic stress disorder, for the PTSD. And when I saw it, I just got chills because I'm like, oh, my God, I fucking thought the same thing. I thought the same thing. So I was like, oh, shit, this is all coming together. Right.
Yeah.
And then I happened to interview this guy and he happened to tell me that his father came up with PTSD. His father came up with that, with the idea of PTSD, with the PTSD, the actual framing, naming of it. Right. And he lives uptown where I live. And I was just like, what do you think? And he was like, you know, that makes sense when I told him my idea. So I see it in the form of how we hate ourselves, you know, in some ways, right? And people will disagree with me. Even the way, for example, that, you know, we say the N-word so much. It's like, I never hear Jews calling each other, you know, racist terms. You just don't, you know, they're not, their Holocaust and their experience, their horrible experience isn't stigmatized. They learn to, you know, learn about it, process it so that it'll never happen again. Right. So why can't we do the same thing? So I see it in all these kind of forms of, like, the way we interact and the way we see ourselves.
Yeah. I would say it seems like that framing is slowly working its way into the public consciousness a little bit. You know, like I said, we've had, you know, Murs, when we had him on the show.
That's my brother.
Yeah, he has a song called PTSD on his latest album that's about growing up in a kind of gang-infested area of Los Angeles and the effect that had on him.
But I didn't consider it PTSD or anything like that until I met a friend of my wife's. He came back from the Middle East. He's a ranger or something. He couldn't get a job, but he sat around and just drank and played Call of Duty all day. I said, that's what my homies do that are out of prison and can't get a job and can't really function. So all they do is drink and play Call of Duty.
And he talked about that. Pharoah Monch has a whole album. His most recent record is PTSD.
Seen death twice. It's ugly motherfucker, man. But you conversate with it when you suffer, man. Let go of the pain. You'll never rock the mic again. Your choice, love to the brain of 20 Vicodin.
I just feel like that,
I didn't know that. Wow.
That kind of framing is, you know, on the uptick a little bit. I was wondering if that was anything you'd notice at all.
I feel like sometimes there's things in the zeitgeist that certain artists or people that I guess don't think in a very linear way that kind of swim against the currents. Mm-hmm. They kind of, I guess Lewis Hyde would call it the gift. There's like a thing. There's a place where we could all pull ideas, and sometimes they're all at the same time. We all pull them out at the same time.
Yeah.
Because I guess it's, you know, our bodies and ourselves can process it. I feel like that, you know, that, so I don't think it's a mistake that it's a Pharoah Monch and a Murs and, you know, and many artists who we'll never hear from because they don't have the social capital or the opportunity. But yeah, I do believe that. I mean, I didn't know that. I knew about Murs, but I didn't know about Pharoah Monch, but I'm not surprised. And I actually read an article that on IndianCountry.com, on a website about Native American culture and news. They were talking about the link between post-traumatic stress disorder being inherent in the DNA of Indigenous Americans, who I call original Americans, right?
Raquel is referring to the May 2015 article from Indian Country Today titled, Trauma May Be Woven into DNA of Native Americans. We've put a link to it in the show notes at thecyphershow.com.
So I think that, you know, we've all been thinking about it, but it's kind of now we're able to articulate it because these things are abstract, right? They're very abstract feelings. And, you know, and I've gotten an email where somebody was like offended by our use of PTSD, but I kind of stand behind it.
Yeah. You know, people are starting to very slowly, I think that way.
And as far as toxic stress goes,
yeah,
that's just a term I've been hearing because from people that work in the field of mental health, mm-hmm. because I'm working on a film, my current documentary.
Right. So a big theme in your memoir, Bird of Paradise, How I Became Latina, ties into some of the stuff we were just talking about, is your family, you know, in particular your father, kind of discouraged you from thinking about yourself as Dominican. And, you know, race was always a very contentious issue. I believe, you know, we're talking about names. I think he even called you Rachel.
He called me Raquel because I was named after Raquel Welch.
Oh, okay.
But when I went to a Catholic grammar school in the area, you know, and surprise, surprise, they wanted to change my name. So people were like, you know, the teachers and the students were like, what's your name? I'm Raquel. You mean Rachel? I said, no, Raquel. Rachel, Raquel. And at some point, I've always had this kind of I don't give a fuck attitude.
Yeah.
I go, yeah, whatever, Rachel, fine. And I kind of like, you know, just gave into it. But people who actually really know me to this day will say Raquel, and people that I was just like, whatever with, mm-hmm. will call me to this day Rachel, and I just answer to both.
Sure. But your father's attitudes toward race, which you go into in the book, how did his attitudes toward race end up affecting your own, the attitudes
well,
you have now?
It kind of had an extreme opposite effect that I guess he wanted to, right? To impose on me, which is that it made me very interested. It made me very, interested in in race. It made me very cognizant of what was going on around me and of what people looked like and really how similar we were. For me, his Stockholm syndrome resulted in my kind of obsession with topics that that revolve around race and identity.
And one of the subtle themes of the book is his lifelong hope that he's actually secretly Jewish.
Which he isn't. But, you know, we and his direct paternal, you know, I'm half my father, so we say R sometimes. You know, our direct paternal lineage on my father's side was Amazigh or Berber. You know, people say Berber, but it's really Amazigh. And 50%, give or take, you know, converted to Judaism because of the political climate of the time. So when I see somebody who's Jewish, I just call them cousin. You know what I mean? Because yeah. At the end of the day, we're related. I believe we're related.
Yeah. One other thing about the book that really struck me, you write so movingly about the Bernard Goetz situation.
Bernard Goetz, also known as the subway vigilante, shot 4 black teenagers on the New York City subway in 1984, paralyzing one. Goetz had been mugged 3 years prior by 3 teens at a subway station, only to see 2 of the attackers get away and one spend a few hours at a police station. He then applied for a gun permit. On December 22, 1984, Goetz entered a nearly empty Manhattan train carrying an unlicensed .38. Also on the car were 4 teenagers, Troy Canny, Barry Allen, Daryl Cabby, and James Ramseur. As witness testimony later stated, Goetz had barely taken a seat when the young men approached Goetz for $5. When Goetz refused, Canny responded, "Give me your money." Goetz stood up and said, "You all can have it," and began firing, injuring all 4. When shooting Cabby, who wound up paralyzed by the second shot, Goetz said, "You don't look so bad, here's another." Goetz stumbled from the train and fled to New Hampshire, returning 8 days later to New York to turn himself in. Among certain New Yorkers, he'd become a folk hero for standing up for himself, while for others he was just a racist who overreacted to kids panhandling. Goetz was acquitted of attempted murder but convicted of illegal firearms possession, for which he served less than a year. He then became a vocal advocate for citizens arming themselves, and later even told one reporter that Cabby's mother would have been better off having an abortion. Cabby eventually won a $43 million civil judgment against Goetz, who immediately declared bankruptcy. There is much more to this story, and we certainly suggest you read up on it, including the section of Raquel's book that covers it.
Can I just tell you something?
Sure.
Do you know, and you're not going to fucking believe this shit, when I typed the word Bernard Goetz, I was in a cafe on 14th Street. He walked right by me. My God, I'm getting like chills. I'm getting chills. Woof. He walked right by me. It was so close to where he shot those kids, you know?
Yeah.
And it just really, it kind of like shook me to my core. But at the same time, I knew that I was going in the right direction, that I was writing about what I was supposed to be writing about. Yeah. But can you believe that? Like, that's one of the things that obviously is not in the book because I'm writing, but it's just one of those crazy asides.
I mean, the thing about writing about him is, you know, I remember the case, you know, as a kid or whatever, but like what you wrote about, I just want to quote it for a second because yeah. It was so amazing. You said it convinced me that everybody in the city, not just Poppy, not just your father, feels that Black and Latino kids are no better than subway tunnel rats.
Yeah.
And so for people who weren't, you know, kids in New York City then, what did it feel like, you know, as a kid of color to see this guy become a folk hero for basically shooting a couple of people just like you?
It felt very natural because the people hated us so much, including the people in our own community. It was like we were vermin, even people that were of color in our own community. And in the beginning, I remember clearly people like kind of lauding this guy. And that's kind of like in originally how I found out, like, what's going on here? And then I saw it on the news or whatever. I thought that case, especially reflecting on it now, and the Central Park 5 case really captures what it felt like.
On April 19th, 1989, a 28-year-old investment banker was brutally raped and beaten in New York's Central Park. Amongst media frenzy over teens wilding in the park, five kids, four Black and one Hispanic, all under 16, were arrested and eventually convicted of many charges for the incident. As we now know, they were intimidated by police and railroaded throughout the court case. In 2001, a convicted serial killer and rapist admitted to the crime, and DNA testing confirmed it. In 2002, their sentences were finally vacated. The then-Mayor Bloomberg and his administration refused to settle a lawsuit brought by the wrongly convicted men, citing that they believed that the city would prevail in court. In 2013, the city, under Bill de Blasio, finally settled for $41 million.
And actually, I was talking to a writer who grew up in the Bronx around the same time. He was a couple years older than me. I was the same age as the guys that were in Central Park 5 case, 15, 16. And that guy was a couple years older. But he said to me, he goes, I got an advanced copy of the Ken Burns documentary, but I can't watch it because it takes me back to that time. And this guy's a hyper successful, like super successful academic and writer. And he just said, I can't because I remember what it was like to feel like we were replaceable. And it felt very dangerous. It felt very like it. Like I remember thinking to myself, that white girl got raped, but if it was somebody of color, and like so many girls I knew, and they weren't even white all the time. Sometimes they were poor or middle class, you know, working class Irish American chicks that I grew up with. When they were assaulted, nobody seemed to care. We knew what was going on, but sometimes they would go unreported, as you know, a lot of cases of rape and sexual assault go unreported. But because we felt like it's like our bodies didn't mean as much as the bodies of richer white people that were around at the time.
You know, moving kind of from there to your work, like artistically, you found your first real home artistically in kind of like the early mid-90s spoken word scene.
Early 90s, yeah.
Yeah.
In 93, 94.
Yeah. What was that scene like for when you first got involved?
That shit was off the chain. It was something that I've never seen captured again. And maybe I'm saying that because I'm older now. And you know how we think everything was so much better when we were doing it. But it's the scene that basically begat the deaf poetry world, right, which was a watered down version of what was going on in like the clubs. And I remember, I mean, one of the best moments was downstairs where Time Cafe was with the Fez. It was called the Fez. Seeing Freestyle Fellowship perform Inner City Boundaries. And just seeing that and seeing how they were just like rap and poetry were very much blurred because you had a lot of people that were doing hip hop music, performing poetry, and a lot of people that were growing up in the hip hop, in a hip hop generation that were influenced by hip hop and actually was going back and forth because we influenced the culture and the culture influenced us. And it was kind of like this, right, concentric thing going on. We were doing poetry that sounded kind of like hip hop because that's what we were inspired by. And the Lost Poets and myself, I liked Allen Ginsberg and, you know, the beat, you know, like the whole kind of beat, anything with a beat, with a pulse, with a, you know, so there, it felt very electric. It was just a time in New York that, I mean, I don't see, but maybe because I'm not as out there as, you know, as some of the kids are today.
Right. So you were, you know, writing poetry your whole life, but didn't really start performing it you know, till this scene.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you performed?
Yeah, I performed some really stupid, corny ass, like, love poem, right? Aching for some, I don't even know what, it was an idea of a guy. The first poem I remember writing that I tried to actually try to perform was deaded by my high school, like the people that, the overlords in my high school at the time. And it was about people of color getting together and about seeing Mandela freed and about Martin Luther King's dream and about all these other things these I was trying to process, but it was just deaded. But when I actually got on stage and I was able to, it was at the New Yorican Poets Cafe. And it was, I don't even remember, it was 93 or 4. It was just around that time, circa around that time. And it was just like some stupid, you know, love sick kind of thing. I guess I was always looking for love from men, right? I didn't get it from my dad. So it was like, looking back, that's what it, I guess that's what it was about. And I remember, you know, just that it resonated with the audience because people that were like twice my age were like, oh, wow, you know, like crazy. And, you know, and then I remember also my last time performing, and it was, and nobody believed that it was going to be my last time, but I remember I was co-hosting one of the first shows at Brooklyn Moon Cafe. Mm. And I remember people snapping their fingers and I was like, this shit is like, what the fuck am I doing here? And I never, ever performed again. That's exactly. And anyway, I wanted to do long form, and it's hard to do long form writing when you're thinking in those kind of phrases, you know?
Right.
And then I was a poetry editor for this magazine called New Word in Brooklyn, which was like such a cool, cool magazine back in the day. And actually, another weird thing, I was going through, because I'm working with Henry Chaff on my new film,
right,
which opens, by the way, in my hood, on my block across the street from my school. And I remember hearing that these white guys were going and filming people that were in Rocksteady. It's just crazy how my this is how my life is.
Right, because when
no coincidences.
When you first moved to
81
back to New York, when you were like 8 or so, graffiti was, you were in your memoir, you noticed the graffiti
everywhere. Yeah, because in Washington Heights, even though it really flourished in the Bronx, Washington Heights was like, it's, I guess, as far as New York City goes, where it kind of began, maybe, arguably, because I'm sure people would argue that, right? But I remember seeing, going through some footage that, I don't know if it made it or didn't make it, but we're going through some, because I'm also on the Style Wars board. And I was like, oh my God. And I saw footage of the guy who owned New Word. And isn't that crazy? I was a poetry editor, and I actually published Saul Williams's first poem, like in print. So that was, you know, it was called Ohm.
The future unfolds in Saturn's rivers, so I sailed my soul through the forethoughts of the forgotten and waded through windows of Ohm. Through meditation, I program my heart to beat breakbeats and hum bass lines on exhalation. Ohm. I burned.
And actually just found it in, like, in my old files. So it was like a lot of, you know, it was like a cool time. It was a really cool time back in that.
So the stuff you were hosting back then, the events you would co-host, you know, often with Razelle.
Yes.
Like you're talking about in the book.
I fucking love Razelle.
Yeah. What would those events be like? Who would be performing? Who'd be in the audience?
There was a time when a lot of like A&R people from like the hip hop labels would come, because it was a scene. It was a real cool scene.
Yeah.
So I would see like all the A&Rs who were hot at the time. I remember one time going in and saying, wait a minute, is that Roger from Rerun? And that was him. The skinny guy from What's Happening. And like Jada Pinkett, you know, before she was Jada Pinkett Smith. The Fugees, of course, and a lot of, you know, people that were doing hip hop and people that were acting, that were young. It was like one of those places where you could just be. You could just, I remember watching Bones once, Bones Malone.
Yeah.
Just, I think he, I don't know if he was opening a Bible and just reading verses, but I just really appreciated that because we didn't have any kind of inhibitions. It's like, okay, I have a Bible or I have a Quran or I have whatever. It didn't matter. We're just, it was the ultimate safe space. And that's, and I feel like people that were acting and that were performing hip hop music and that were, you know, in the culture and that were in the scene, some models, hip hop label heads were all like, you know, hanging out there, unwinding there.
Yeah. Well, speaking of hip hop label heads, your big thing after that was going to One World magazine, where
Russell, you know, Simmons, One World. Yeah.
You know, you're 29, 30. You're the editor in chief of a major magazine at that point. How'd you get involved in One World, and kind of what was your vision for what you wanted it to be?
Well, I got involved in One World after I met John Passmore, who was the owner of the publisher. And it was his blood, sweat and tears that actually manifested that magazine. And he was working with me at, I was working at a place called Hooked/SayShe.com, where we, you know, were, you remember the doing the .com bubble and that whole yeah. when everybody was getting like mad cash thrown at them. Like,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So he was working there and I was working there and I was a co-founder slash editor-in-chief of the women's site. And he was there and we kind of like, you know, dug each other and dug each other's vibe. And when I finally quit and went to Brazil, I got an email from him and he was like, yo, you know, when you come back, let's talk or whatever. And we came back and we had a conversation and we kind of wanted the same things. We kind of seen that the culture was maturing. That there was a generation that wasn't being spoken to, and that we can expand the definition of what it meant to be urban into a global one. And for me, that was natural because, you know, just by way of being born, I understood that there was a world that existed outside of my own little world.
Right.
So he allowed me, he really gave me, more so than anybody that I've ever worked with, kind of the reins to just go and do what I wanted to do. And that magazine ended up being from when I was there, September 2001 to January or the end of December 2004, everything I wanted it to be. And when it stopped being that, I had to step away.
Right. You know, another piece you did that I saw right around the time of your beginning at One World, although it wasn't for One World, it was for Essence. You know, you are a former tennis prodigy, grew up playing tennis and mm-hmm. competing at a very high level at the urging of your father. And
the forcing.
So,
yeah.
The forcing of your father. And so, you know, 2001 comes and you meet these 18, 19 year old sisters who are women of color, tennis prodigies, also coached by their father and sort of molded into champions by their father. What was it like meeting Venus and Serena Williams at that point?
I've heard about them before, you know, obviously. And I've heard that it was these two young girls from Compton. And I was always hearing rumblings. It was lovely to meet Serena because she was so incredibly gracious and nice. And there's something about her that I can tell that even if she wasn't a tennis star, she'd just be like a super kind person, infectious, bold with her fashion statements. And just, you know, that's not easy. I mean, it sounds stupid and easy now. I'm talking about fashion or whatever, but not for a young person who's in the global spotlight and is vilified
right.
by so many people, right? And back then, remember how like people were the press and just critics and people were like relentlessly like dissing them, right?
Yeah.
So for her to just be like this kid and this open and very strong, I was like, damn, I was kind of jealous of her abs. And so I was like this jealousy and at the same time, like this awe of how beautiful and mature she was. And I remember thinking to myself when I met her and talked to her, like, I really hope my daughter comes out with that kind of grace. You know, like I was really like, really taken aback. I didn't think too much about tennis when I spoke to her. Venus, on the other hand, I don't really have too much to say. When I was trying to talk to her about my father, my experience, I just remember her yawning. And I'm going to leave that there.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So after One World, you edited And It Don't Stop,
yeah.
an anthology of hip-hop journalism. Great book. It spanned basically the genre's entire history, more or less, from 2004 back to, yeah. you know, when it first started being written about, you know, in the early 80s. How did you choose what to include? Like, what were some of the criteria you were thinking about?
Well, I was at toward the end of my tenure at One World, and I would go up to Nelson George's office at the time. And just when he wasn't around and just use it and put all these articles out and kind of try not to even look at the bylines. This is, to me, it was like, okay, there were so many articles that deserved to be part of it that I read that I wanted to include, sure. but I couldn't make it a 2,000 page
anthology. Yeah.
So I had very strict, like, you know, rules about what I could do, what I could not do, what to do and what I couldn't do.
Right.
You know, I looked at it and I said, okay, well, we have to sequence this. And what are the moments for me that kind of like were moments in hip hop? The first moment was, you know, Stephen Hager. That's a good moment. Sally Baines is a good moment. For me personally, when she wrote about this, not competition, but show that Rocksteady Crew was supposed to have. And basically at the end of the day, the Ballbusters, which were a gang in my neighborhood when I was growing up, just totally fucked everything up and they had beef and it was all this stuff. And for me, that was kind of a memory.
Yeah.
So it kind of struck an emotional chord. So I wanted to like include that. And I know I pulled a lot out of the Village Voice, but they were just doing spectacular work. And for me, that was like, that was my textbook. That was my everything back in that time. I was obsessed with The Voice. It was, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's what made me actually reading The Voice and reading like the pieces in there was what made me want to be a journalist.
Yeah. I definitely remember that era really well.
Oh, there was some great articles. I remember like reading Joe Morgan talk about Ice Cube. And I was like, wow, you don't only have to just review a song and say that this song sounds like this song sounds like that. This is what the machines that they're using. You can actually look at our isms, feminism and all kind of isms and, you know, and culture, and critique our culture by using this music as a prism. And that really turned me on.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned The Voice. I wanted to jump ahead a little bit. Maybe like 5-6 years ago, you wrote a pretty depressing piece for The Voice in the wake of the Rihanna and Chris Brown incident, where you talked to middle school kids. And, you know, the takeaway from the article was that middle school kids of both genders were blaming Rihanna, essentially, for what happened.
Yes, because, you know, they're reflections of their parents, right? And this is a time when you're sopping everything up like a piece of bread and your parents are like gravy and everything they say, right? You're just taking it in. And that was actually my daughter's school at the time. And I just thought about, like, just how sad, because I was hearing what people were saying. And I was like, wow, this has to be written about, because, you know, these kids are what represent, you know, New York and America and like the common person, not some professors, you know, like, right? Like, well, you know, like these are just regular kids, right? So it was very depressing, but I think that we are desensitized to all kinds of violence against women. You see it today, even online. If a man doesn't like, for example, if you don't like an article, not you personally, but like if you don't like an article, a piece that, you know, a guy wrote, you'll say, oh, I don't agree with this. You know, you'd be an asshole. Blah, blah, blah. But when it's a woman, it's like, I want to fucking, you know, like you, it gets to a whole other level. You bitch, you this, you that. Even, and it comes from men and from women. Because, you know, we're misogynistic towards each other a lot of the time, right? That's an issue that people rarely speak about, but that's what happens. It's like this hate.
Right.
So, you know, it was terrible, terrible to report on that. But yeah, and I don't know if it was depressing for me as much as it was like just like a wake up call. I was hoping that parents would read it and really talk to their kids, or to even reflect themselves on how they were seeing violence against women. But it's like it's inherent.
Yeah.
It's something that's just like, you know, we're just desensitized to it. You know?
Yeah. It was women in some ways a brutal article to read.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine to report on.
Yeah. It was like crazy. And also like talking to some of the teachers, I was like, God, man, we are in a fucked up place as a society. When is this world going to blow up already? And when are we going to start over?
Right. And moving back to just one of the bigger things you did, you did a movie, Bling, a documentary. Great movie. I think came out in like 2007.
Yeah.
It's, you know, for people who haven't seen it, you take a couple artists to Sierra Leone to see actually what is going on there, what the Civil War has wrought, its connection to diamonds.
And how, you know, we're connected to it, how we're all interconnected.
Yeah.
How did American hip hop culture inform for the better and for the worse what was going on in this, what some people call the, children's war.
Yeah.
To me, because these guys, the guys that I took, you know, Tego Calderon, who's a Puerto Rican hip hop artist / reggaeton artist, but really more of a hip hop artist and now actor. And Paul Wall, who back then had that song Grills, and you know, he was like a businessman before he was a rapper.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Raekwon the chef, who, like, you know, Wu-Tang, I have to say, is the most recognizable, probably adored hip hop outfit to ever come out of our culture. And they are like, as much as I, you know, and I can say this, as much as Tupac is worshipped, they are. So I remember when I first went there by myself with my DP at the time, you know, everybody was like, please bring back, you know, anybody from Wu-Tang, anybody from Wu-Tang. And I was hearing all the Wu-Tang music in the clubs when we were there. And it was just like, okay, this has to happen.
Yeah.
So I wanted to show them the firsthand effects of, like, you know, what the stuff that we laud and we wear and we rock, how it affects people that look like us in other communities.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so much to, you know, unpack about that movie. You talked about Tego, and there's this moment early on with him where he's talking about, you know, jewelry, nice cars, all this stuff. And he says, essentially, you know, I'm paraphrasing, I didn't really want any of that. I was fine driving my, like, you know, everyday car around. But the kids and my fans started to think that I wasn't successful because they didn't see me with all this ostentatious stuff. So I had to start getting it.
I used to roll on my fucking Toyota Tercio. I still have it. But kids used to tell me, yo, what's up with you? That was broke. They want to see you shine. They want to see you on that fucking Navigator, on that shit. They like that. And the way I saw it was like, I don't want to go to fucking McDonald's in a fucking Mercedes. when these people are getting paid $350 an hour for those an hour, I thought they were going to get disrespected by that. But it's the other way around.
Yep. Because he doesn't really care. He doesn't really give a shit.
Right.
I brought him because I've always wanted to bring him because, you know, he's like a really interesting guy.
You wrote about him a few times during the sort of reggaeton craze.
Yeah. And also because he kind of represented me, you know, the Latino American kind of component to the film. And we have so many of the same at that time, at least, of the same ideas that I just felt like, oh, my God, this guy has to. I want to make it global.
Yeah. And so what was the point of including, you know, I assume you had a ton of interview footage. Why include that little section in the film of his kind of feeling like he was forced into wearing jewelry?
Because those are all the nuances that I try to get away with. There were so many things that I couldn't get away with because at the end of the day, like Viola Davis said at the Emmys, you know, what separates, you know, women of color from their white counterparts is just opportunity, not talent. So I had to, you know, basically, the way when people ask me what was it like to make Bling, I'm like, it was just like sleeping with the devil. I had to dance and sleep with the devil a lot. And in that, I had to, you know, make sure that I was able to get the things that I thought were important into the film. And those are one of the things, because I look at everything. The conversations that we're having in society are too binary. They're too black and white. But this was kind of like getting in the middle, like, you know, kind of like getting in between the cracks. And people that were around me were like, whatever, that doesn't really mean anything, because they weren't part of the community. They just were seduced by it, if you will. They just wanted to be seen with rappers and, you know, and say that they knew rappers, but they didn't really understand where we came from. Not me being a rapper, but being in the hip hop community, where we came from. And I felt like that was very important. And thank the gods, my editor, John Kirby, really believed in what I was doing and believed in everything, you know, the reasons why I wanted to keep these, you know, morsels in.
Mm-hmm.
And was kind of, you know, him and his production, his partner, Libby Handros, just became like my mouthpieces, because even though I'm the only one from the cultures is about hip hop, you know, and I'm a woman, it was like a double, triple whammy to justify everything I wanted to do.
Sure. So one of the key sections to me in the movie is when the artists come face to face with, I believe, the CEO of a diamond.
A former mercenary. It's in context. There are context clues everywhere.
They come face to face with the CEO of a mining operation. And it seems like they're just kind of processing everything they've seen, all of the, you know, orphans and victims of the war and so forth that they've seen. And also processing this guy in front of them who's a real person and who says, you know, talks about giving people jobs and so forth. And they're just trying to work through everything while talking to this person in the moment. At least that's how it comes off on film.
Do you think the diamonds were cause of the war? That's not the reason why there was a war.
No, you're right. Diamonds wasn't the cause of the war. What was the cause of the war was poverty, was people not having nothing, people not having no water, no food, no electricity. How could you live without these things? So therefore, you're walking dead. You're walking dead, right?
Okay, right, but we need to move away from that, and how are we going to get out of it? We have to utilize the resources we have in order to improve ourselves and get a better future.
Right,
this is a start. This is a start. It's not going to happen overnight. Come, let me take you to the side.
What was that like for you to see? How did that moment, how was that, you know, the same or different as you thought it might be when you set up that,
let me tell
that
you,
meeting?
At some point, I had to stop making eye contact with the people that were the guys that I brought, because they were, it's like when you grow, you know, growing pains. It's like, it hurts, it, you know, but you're doing it in front of a lot of people. And at the same time, you're a hip hop artist. So you're used to, like, in the beginning, you see Raekwon talking to the camera.
I feel good. I smell good. My waves is up. I got my brother with me. That's my co-partner when we come to doing the things we do.
You're used to, like, being in front of the camera. But this is so much of, like, this is like a tsunami of emotion, right? That it's like hard to process it, and you're actually breaking down and forgetting that the camera's even there. So it kind of makes you angry in some ways. Not angry at me, I didn't do it, but like just angry at what the situation and the fact that I was placing them in that, in those moments. But I felt like it was important because through them, our audience was able to see. Is it more powerful for them to see me going through it, who they don't give a shit about, or these artists that they look up to? So, you know, I think they all had a very life-altering experience.
Here's what Paul Wall had to say about the experience in Cypher episode 126.
It definitely affected me because
I could see things, and you know, it's just seeing people in like that. It's like you, it opens your eyes up to a lot of things. You know what I'm saying? And I felt a lot of accountability. I felt a responsibility, and those are things that I started feeling after that. Like, damn, man, I gotta. I'm not just out here living for me. It was a combination of a lot of things, a lot of growing up, and that trip really just helped me grow up.
And also, I wanted the guys to know, listen, it's not only in America, and it's not only, let's say, in Europe, but people really look to what you're saying as gospel. You know, I'm not saying for you that you are supposed to place yourself in a position of, you know, hero or community leader, because a lot of these guys don't come into the hip hop to do that. But just understand that, you know, what you say has an effect on other people, and what you do and the way you comport yourselves and whatever has, you know, present yourselves has an impact.
And you got such, you know, real emotional moments out of the guys, even in, you know, there's, you know, moments when, you know, Raekwon doesn't want to face a essentially hospital full of war amputees.
A lot of the people here, you'll see, have lost their hands. They've lost their feet. Some of them have lost their ears. They've lost their lips. You know, and that's
what we're going to see?
That's what we're going to see right now.
Oh, man.
How you feeling, man? You okay?
I ain't feeling good, man. I don't want to see that, though, yo. Just overall, it's like it's just sad to see somebody like that, man.
You all right?
I ain't really ready to go address that right now and see that, you know what I mean, physically, you know what I mean? My heart is where it's supposed to be for it, you know what I mean? For the people and all that, but yo, it hurts you, you know what I mean? I'm not saying I don't want to see the people and,
yeah,
you know what I mean? I just don't want to see them like that, man.
Let's do this, man. Yeah, all right.
It wasn't a hospital. It was their community. They were, and actually, I remember when I first went down there, they were in the center of Freetown. And, you know, when I went there to present my, you know, what I was doing, what I was trying to do to the Council of Elders there with an interpreter who actually was a very popular writer. I don't think he's from Sierra Leone. I think he's from Ghana. He's from Ghana or Sierra Leone, but he was a very, very important writer, and he was served as our translator for a while. Until he tried to force himself on me. So he tried to force, like this is the other thing people don't know, right? When the things that women go through is like not even funny. Like we had a driver, and we had my DP. She went to go get some shots and pickup shots and what you call beauty roll, B-roll. On the beach, he turned around and just took my face and tried to kiss me. And I went like this to him. And this is like a very important like writer in that world and in the world of human rights. Right. And he told me that I reminded him of his Brazilian girlfriend or whatever, his ex-girlfriend or whatever. And then I remember telling my homegirl, because she was the DP, this woman, like, yo, what he did. And she was like, that's fucked up. And I was like, yeah, we're really like going to take it, bring it to him. And he just denied it. Like it could never happen because we are that desensitized to not respecting women's bodies and women in general. So he was there. And he was like, and I was in the middle of Freetown at this amputee camp, and I was like talking to them and whatever. And then as soon as I finished my plea, someone please call 911. That song with Wyclef and Mary J. Blige.
Yeah. I need y'all to do me a favor.
Someone please call 911.
Pick up the phone, yo.
Tell them I just been shot down in the bullets in my heart.
It started like playing in the amputee, in the somebody had a boombox or something or radio, and it started playing. And the guy was like, "I said, you see that guy? He's a rapper. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to bring the two worlds together." And that's when it was like, you know, okay, we can do this. By the time we went back with the artist, they had moved them, the amputee camp, 45 minutes outside of Freetown, which I thought was totally fucked up because they're trying to erase the problem in order to bring tourism into the country. So it was really hard to get out there. And I was like really disgusted at how they were just being like, you know, kind of pushed to the fringes. But we, you know, it was a great experience. And while it was hard to come out of the bus for some people, I'm sure they all happy that they did it because, you know, we have to experience things.
Yeah.
You know, like they were blessed to have this voice to be that resonates with so many people, you know, and you give so much to your fans. This is you giving back a little bit.
Yeah. So I do have to talk about what is in some ways the elephant in the room with Bling, which is, you know, you about 4 years after you start work on a documentary about diamonds from Sierra Leone and the rappers who wear them, Kanye West, who is interviewed in your film, releases a song about diamonds from Sierra Leone and the rappers who wear them.
Good morning, this ain't Vietnam still. People lose hands, legs, arms for real. Little was known of Sierra Leone and how we connect to the diamonds we own. When I speak of diamonds in this song, I ain't talking about the ones to be cloned. I'm talking about Rockefeller, my home, my chain.
What was so, remember I was telling you that there's a certain place that artists, I'm not saying only rappers, but artists in general kind of pull from?
Yeah.
All these, everybody all of a sudden was like talking about Sierra Leone. And I remember it took me altogether 7 years to make the film.
Right.
Because I was researching for so long. And I would, you know, part of One World was that we would always feature a community, you know, international hip hop. So we did Cuba and we did New Zealand and we did, you know, hip hop on the res. And we, so, but I would never, I would, you know, in Brazil, but I would never do Sierra Leone because I wanted to keep it for a film for myself. So I would go in early before everybody else and do research. And I remember in the beginning when I would Google, nothing came up. Then little by little, by little, by little. So then I was like, oh my God, before I went to Sierra Leone the first time on that fact finding mission, when I was getting ready, the song came out. And I said, what the fuck? And I like, you know, basically got my Q-tip to hook up a meeting with me and Kanye. And I was asking Kanye, like, how did you find out about this? And he said, well, basically it was Q-tip. But I was the one who kind of told Q-tip about what was going on around, like, post 9/11, like around, right after 9/11. I remember we were all in Union Square coffee shop. And we're sitting outside and we're eating. And I remember, like, there was a time when it was like all the reason why I say it's right, like close to after 9/11, is because you would hear all the sirens and all these, you know, you were always hearing sirens at the time and airplanes flying low. So that's how I marked that time. And I remember, you know, talking to him about that. And then he was like, wow, that shit is that's happening. I was like, yeah, you know. And we were just talking, you know, exchanging. I was learning things. He was learning things. We exchanged information. And then, you know, Kamal Q-Tip is friends with a lot of the artists. And he obviously he knows, as an elder statesman, he knows a lot of the people that have been inspired by his music. And Kanye West, I would say, would be one of those people. They're talking. And then that comes up. So by the time I got there, he was like, he knew who I was. You know, we were talking and it was good. And actually, he did another remix where he had somebody speak Creole in the beginning.
Unfortunately, while we tried to get a copy of the remix for you to hear, the song was never released.
And I got that guy for him that night that we first spoke.
Wow.
You know, so it was to me, it was all symbiotic. And then I had, you know, and then he stopped performing it and it was fine. But actually, I took the song and I played it for the hip hop community in Sierra Leone for the first time. I had them all together in my hotel lobby. And they came in and I said, you guys, I want to play something for you. And they were like, what the fuck? And then I took their reactions and gave them back to Kanye.
Wow.
And it was a very powerful moment. And I wanted to do something where we released a video, but I was working with people that were just like I said, devils. So I couldn't do anything on my own. Like, it was just like really, like I was like shackled the entire time.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one of the things I was curious about is how you deal with those kinds of compromises. You talked about them in regards to Bling. I know you've said that literally even the subtitle of your book, How I Became Latino, was in some ways
a compromise
with
yeah.
the marketing people at your
The marketing
your
people who
house.
Like decided not to market. It's funny because it was such a problem, right? But then I'm like, because I just wanted it to be Bird of Paradise. Why do I have to always like be like, Latina, or, you know, like, why do I always have to overstate? Why can I have said Dominican, which is how I really identify, right? Yeah. But, you know, it had to be what it had to be, right? And sometimes you just have to, I understand in life, you know, I say to myself, okay, well, not a lot of Dominican Americans get to write memoirs. Actually, I don't know any other Dominican Americans who've written memoirs. They write amazing novels, right? Like Juno Diaz and stuff. You know, it's a compromise. You have to do it, or, you know, In my mind, I'm like, well, if I don't do this, then they're not going to do this. And kind of it's like a give and take because you're not self-funding, right? So, you know, as far as the book goes, I had to like give into that because then how about if they said, okay, well, we're just going to name it, you know, some corny, horrible, you know, dry name and not even give me any kind of, you know, input.
Right.
But it was funny, and I made the joke about it not being marketed. But I remember a couple of weeks before the book came out, my agent called me and said to me, "Are you sitting down?" I was like, "Yeah." She was like, "Well, because Simon & Schuster, who's a parent company of Atria, who put out my book, and Barnes & Noble were at an impasse when they were having this beef. They canceled all your books all around the country." So then by the time, you know, so I was like, okay, well, let me write a plan B. So my agent and I, you know, got together and we were trying to, you know, find a plan B, how to market, you know, more intimately to the smaller, more independent shops, which is what I like anyway. You know, they just decided not to do it. We couldn't even get a marketing meeting. It's like, what the fuck? It's like when you look at the publishing industry and you're like, you know, they're suffering, they're like, you know, imploding. I mean, when you work, you know, within the industry, when you see what, you know, the experiences that so many of us have gone through, I'm not a victim. I'm just one of the many. You can't wonder. You don't wonder. You see why. You can see why it's right there in front of your face, why the shit is imploding.
Right.
I mean, it'd be great if these editors and publishing people were to just step foot outside of their houses, their cubicles, their publishing houses, and see what's going on in the world. And stop, you know, being so binary in the way that they market and sell and push everything.
So speaking of books, you are working on a book right now.
Yes, called East of Broadway.
East of Broadway. Appropriately enough, it's about New York City, about gentrification. And we are in Harlem, in a neighborhood they tried somewhat unsuccessfully to brand as Soho for a while.
Yeah, that's annoying. But you know what's crazy? I was thinking about that when I was walking here. And I said, look at me, because the book really is about my ambivalence because, you know, I come from the gentrified. But, you know, I have educated, I've traveled, I have values that are more aligned with the gentry, but not the revanchist kind of vibe where it's like, I'm taking this shit back. I'm taking it, you know, this kind of a thing that's kind of abstract and racist and kind of, you know, and kind of like dominating and very colonial about the way that, you know, a lot of New York is being, you know, I guess, regentrified, right? But at the same time, I have to keep it real because I made a joke to myself, a quip, and I said, okay, I'm going into this building. And I looked around and I was like, okay, this is definitely part of the problem. But then look at me, I'm walking in there with a Starbucks coffee. So it's kind of that kind of a book. Like, where do I fit in? I'm in the middle. I'm kind of in the middle. And I don't want it to be all about like all the gentry, they're all bad and the gentrified are all victims because that's not how the world works. For me, Bling was the best example of that. That's when I really said to myself, my God, this world is not black and white. It's gray. We exist in the gray area. It's lazy to be in the binary, just to be satisfied with just being in that place.
Yeah. And so as someone who's lived in New York for, you know, the vast majority of your life, is there something different about the gentrification of maybe the past decade or so, either in kind or in pace?
I feel like the pace is definitely more rapid. And the kind is like, you know, I was talking to a very, very dear friend of mine, a white man, older, part of the 1%. And he came in to the New York City decades ago. And I was like, well, what the fuck is the difference? Because I feel it, but because I wasn't an adult then, I can't necessarily articulate it. And what I've gathered talking to him and other people of that time was that when artists moved here, they kind of like just became part of like the community. They weren't trying to impose themselves or, you know, use their money to come in with a condo that their parents bought them. You know what I mean? They came here with a different kind of vibe. You know what I mean? Than the people now, which is more like more of an aggressive kind of unrelenting kind of like my grandparents left here because it was, you know, white flight, but I'm fucking taking this shit back and I'm taking it at all cost, you know, by all means necessary. So it's that kind of vibe that I'm trying now to, you know, while I'm doing interviews and researching, trying to articulate because it's hard. You know, things are always changing. And, you know, I have a 3-year-old son and an 18-year-old daughter. And I'm glad that my daughter doesn't feel the way I did growing up in New York. But then again, that vibe of New York when I was growing up, you have the LGBT culture. Really, you know, and revolution beginning in New York and Stonewall, right? Then you have like, you know, the beatnik, like kind of vibe and the whole like new journalism, which is Norman Mailer and Allen Ginsberg and all those like really cool cats that are writing that are not from New York necessarily, but, you know, have moved here. You have like this great, you know, hip hop, you have classic salsa, You have all these things that I could see how they can be born. You know, when you are walking in the streets in the early 80s, you could see how you're part of this, you know, this continuum. But now I feel like the cement is so buried so deep, deep, deep down that it's almost like you can't hear what's going on anymore. You can't hear what, you know, what your artistic ancestors want to pass on to you, because we're on top, like they're banks and like cement and shit like that just built atop of New York, and it's totally fucking it up. The other problem here is Williamsburg, I can tell you. I really, really, really don't get it. I mean, you come in here, I think, you know, so far, I think the coolest artistic expression to articulate what is happening with gentrification has come from Danny Hock. He has a one-man show called Taking Over.
This is a resurgent neighborhood with a very big difference, okay? A resurgent neighborhood, it means it used to be a bustling commercial hub here about 100 years ago. And then after that, you know, people were poor and suffering or whatever. And now everything is resurging around. It's like a metric surge. You know, I mean, I got 3,000 units to fill, so I need places that make outsiders feel welcome. I mean, the locals, they already feel welcome. Who cares about them? Excuse me. I'm talking about a couple that came from Maryland but just wants to settle in a safe neighborhood but with the right level of zing, you know?
And it was set in Williamsburg because that's where he lives, and how these changes happened around him. And he says at the end, well, you know, I date girls who are not from New York, who are gentrifying the area. And, you know, I'm stuck in the middle, and seeing him, you know, process that whole experience in the play was like, it was amazing. I was clapping and screaming so loud at the public that I was like, they were like, you're going to have to leave if you don't shut up. And then I remember seeing it also at Hostos in the Bronx. And when he was performing it, there was a point where people were clapping so loudly and so raucously that he had to stop and wait. And then, because they were like, this motherfucker's speaking for me. This guy is speaking for me. Like, he's really, you know, as a New Yorker, that's one of the things, like, we, you know, Danny may be, you know, Jewish and white or Jewish and whatever. I don't know how he identifies. But it doesn't matter. Like, this thing transcends race. This thing that was happening, you know, in our generation. It's, you know, it transcends it now. So I just, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just feel like people are coming here. And I remember watching the news and they were talking about people that were voting for the first time. Who are you going to vote for or whatever? And I remember seeing these, like, fucking goofballs in Times Square, and the news anchor was like, so where do you live? And everybody's like, Williamsburg, Brooklyn, right? And they were like, and who are you voting for? Which I don't know why they would ask that, because you're not supposed to really ask people who they're voting for. They were all Republican. So it's like, no matter how far you run away, you're always going to confront yourself.
Right.
So I'm just dealing with this because I have also a guilt, because I you know, get along with, I mean, I wouldn't say that, you know, goofballs like that, but there are a lot of people that I think that have really enriched my life that come from other areas.
Right.
And that I... And
some of your best friends are gentrifiers.
Yeah. Some of my best friends are gentrifiers. You know what I mean? So, yeah. But then they're also from the gentrified class. But those people are just trying so hard to survive what's going on now that they don't even have time to have any kind of resentment.
Yeah.
They're just like trying to fucking live.
Yeah. And, you know, you talked about politics a second ago. I saw a bunch of stuff you did around the census.
The
2010 census. There's so much that we get into about that. But one thing is, you know, on the way in today, I told Josh, I said, you have to watch this segment that Raquel did on CNN about 5 years ago.
That's where I met Baratunde.
And I don't even remember his name, the stuff white people like guy.
Christian something.
Christian Lander.
Yeah.
And in a absolutely insane Don Lemon.
I never thought of it. I got my census form, it's right here. And I saw Negro. For some reason, maybe I'm just old school or I just didn't think about it, I'm too busy. It didn't offend me. I just really didn't even think twice about it.
I didn't like him from back then. I don't know.
From the perspective of someone watching it, it seemed like he was pretty out of control, sort of all over the place, didn't really know or care anything about.
He only cared about Baratunde being on there because he was like, I don't know who she is, what she is.
He calls you Rach at one point.
He did call me Rachel? Yeah. I didn't realize that.
And I'm going to stick with you just on this question, Raquel.
That's
what was that segment?
Now I dislike him even more.
Just to watch that segment was so insane.
What a douchebag.
What do you remember about it?
I just remember it just saying to myself, God, I really hate television. Like, like there's so many things. Like, what I like about doing a podcast is that you don't have to speak in sound bites, and you don't have to be the anchor's footnote. So, you know, when you go and you go, you know, I believe this. Am I right, Sean? Am I right? You know what I mean? Like, and you go, yes, because of this, this, that. So I'm basically just there to suit your, right? To just be your footnote, to be your, but then how about if I disagree? Or how about if I want to add something, or I want to talk about something that's complex? There's just no space for that on television. And I just remember thinking to myself, having those same exact thoughts. And I was feeling really sick that day. And I was like, I was sweating. I was coming down with a fever. And then I was just thinking to myself, oh God, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. And this guy is such, he's so idiotic. I mean, that was my, you know, impression of him as we were doing this. I mean, the good side is I would have never met Baratunde had we not done this show together. So that was a fun experience. But I was like, oh my God, I produced that bit. I talked to these people, and that's all you're coming away with is all of these like very surfacey kind of stupid questions. Like, really?
Yeah.
But then I'm like, okay, now I understand why you're on TV and why you have your own show. Because, you know, when you think about it, everybody kind of fits. I think the best person right now, at least in my opinion, and I've never been on a show, unfortunately, I would be on a show if you asked me, if you invited me, is Chris Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he's more like, you know, kind of like, yo, let's just cut the bullshit and just talk about like the issues. And I kind of like that kind of, you know, that kind of speak, that kind of like conversational tone.
Well, hopefully he survives all the coming MSNBC shakeups.
I know. And you know what? If he doesn't survive it on television, he should go online, because I think online is where it's at anyway.
Mm-hmm. So all the stuff you did around the census was around this idea of like Latino is an ethnicity and not a race on the census form.
Are you at all confused by the racial categories that are offered to Latinos in the census?
Absolutely, because there are a lot of African and there are a lot of Black. That are Latino and Hispanic. What I also see very interesting is that underneath the Hispanic, Latino, or Spanish origin, you've got a Mexican, Chicano, Puerto Rican, and a Cuban slot. So, you know, I was born in Puerto Rico. All my family is Cuban. And then on top of that, I'm white.
And how Latinos and Latinas think about race, like, kind of doesn't match up to what's on the form and stuff like that. Like, how did you first become aware and sort of become so involved in reporting on the census?
I just am very interested in reporting about race and ethnicity and identity and how people see themselves and one another. And that was just another example of how, you know, it was coming around. It was a census. And I was just interested in how, you know, I don't believe that every Latino, you know, is like self-loathing, doesn't want to be Black. That's just like some, to say that is just to kind of expose what an idiot you are.
Right.
Because nobody, you can't talk about anybody like they're a monolith, right? Any group, like they're a monolith.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, I want to talk to people. I want to know what the hell is going on. I want to talk to everybody, to people that are white, Black, and other, right? So I remember, and I had a feeling that some of this issue is that people, like your parents may not speak English, and they're saying negro, you know, or they're saying, you know, like they're saying negro, and they're saying, well, I may be Black, but I'm Black Honduran, or I'm Black, you know, Brazilian, or I'm Black Chilean, or I'm Black, you know, Ecuadorian, or whatever. They may not think that it's translating in the same way when they look at the census and they have to translate it here. So some of the people that I interviewed did, you know, it didn't make the cut, but some of them, you know, were running into that problem. And there was a guy I remember meeting from Honduras who was like, yo, I say, you know, I identify as Black. My mother is very like pro-Black, but she doesn't think that, you know, she says negro on the census. It just doesn't make sense to her. And then there were some other, I had, my favorite interview was with these two white women that were visiting from the South. And they were saying, well, I mean, people don't even look at like white people, like, you know, in the way that they should. She was like, I want to be like, I have background, like I'm French American. You know, my ancestors were from France and, you know, I have some German. Why can't I be German American or Irish American? Or
the easiest category here is white. Why is it so easy? Because white people also have very, very
yes, absolutely. I agree. I always wonder why we're all grouped together as white, although I wouldn't necessarily know what I am. Where do I belong?
Where do you belong?
Well, I've got some Indian in there too. So, you know, but a one drop Indian doesn't make me Indian. I'm still classified as white, so.
So do you think that that's fair? Do you think that that these racial categories represent the true composition of America today?
No.
No.
I think that people just look at them, and she pulled on her hair, and she says, and I probably have some, you know, Black blood in me, too. I want to know, and I don't want people to see me as a monolith,
mm-hmm.
as being one thing. So I think that, you know, I would be interested in leaving a blank space for you to be able just to identify yourself. I'm interested in seeing what people would say if you were just able to just identify yourself. I just check everything.
Nice. And, you know, this stuff about ancestry obviously ties into things you've done with DNA, which, yeah, you know, features into Bird of Paradise. It also features into the film that you're currently working,
yeah,
on, right? What can you tell?
It's a documentary called Some Girls, and I'm at rough cut stage. So I'm in post-production, I'd say. And it's basically following a group of troubled Latina teens, mm-hmm, from a suicide prevention program located in the Bronx. And some of the girls are transformed by an exploration of their roots. And some of that exploration includes mitochondrial ancestral DNA testing. And I'm doing that because I wanted them. mtDNA is your mother's 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 side, right? And because a lot of the girls come from single parent, single family homes, and they're, you know, and there's a, you know, connection with them and their moms, and not sometimes not with them and their dads, that I wanted this to kind of be like a female empowerment kind of project. And some of them didn't have brothers. You know, if I were to test a Y DNA, I need a man because women don't inherit the Y chromosome. So, it's been a really interesting project, and, you know, we're really happy with it so far. And we have, like, it's, you know, it's verite with some animation.
And, you know, one of the things that documentary ties into, and something you've written about in the past, is that Latina girls have a very high rate of both teen pregnancy, which you wrote about,
yeah,
about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And of, you know, suicide ideation, suicide,
yes,
attempts.
Yeah.
What have you managed to discover through your work about the possible underlying causes of these issues and maybe possible ways to deal with them?
Some of them are, you know, trying to negotiate the old world values of your parents, which is, for example, you know, you're being domesticated, you're in the house, your brother gets to do everything they want, they get to go outside, they get to do, you know, just go to school, they encourage to do all these things, but then you're kind of like, you know, encouraged to kind of like stay at home, take care of your brothers and sisters, or take care, you know, just be at home, right? Be domesticated. And what does that do to some girl who is, you know, in New York City or in America, anywhere in America, and wants to have the freedom that her brother does and wants to have the freedom that maybe the women in her family didn't have in the old world, right? In the old country, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
How do they negotiate that? Also, you know, there's a problem with, you know, sexual violence. Also, you know, when it comes to their experiences in school, when I first started working with the girls and they were telling me their experiences in school, they were very similar to my own, where, you know, teachers were like, you're never going to be anything. They were very apathetic. And they're kind of taught to be, you know, not to lead companies, but kind of like to open the doors for the people that are walking in to those buildings. So that kind of dusts into your spirit. Then you're also in a community where, you know, you see these ideas of beauty around you and their beauty is all white. It's, you know, it's very phenotypically European. And you look at yourself and you don't fit in. And then at the same time, you know, and this is coming from some of those girls that I spoke to, you know, you're not white enough or you're not black enough to fit into any of the dominant, you know, cultures. You know, the white girls call you illegal. They assume you're illegal. And the black Americans are like, you know, well, you speak Spanish, you're not black, even though you may be phenotypically black. So it's like this thing that they're stuck in the middle there. And then on top of that, they're teenagers. And that's an awkward
stage.
Which is
awful for everybody.
It's awful for everybody. So you compound all that stuff. Then when you do have girls that do go and get treatment, a lot of times their therapists are not culturally competent. So, you know, we look at things, you know, in a different way than what, you know, process things in a way that culturally may not speak to who is currently dominating in the world of mental health. So, you know, it's like a mixture of all these things. So when these girls, you know, found out that I was doing this ancestral DNA, you know, a project, they were like, yo, that sounds crazy. I want to know where I come from. And it kind of like, you know, helps kind of ground them in something.
Yeah.
You know, ground them in something. So it's been a really great project, even though the numbers are getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Latin American teens are almost twice as likely as their Black American counterparts and almost three times as likely as their white American counterparts to fantasize and or try to kill themselves, to commit suicide. So it's a problem that whether you're Latino or not, you should care about because it's going to have an effect on our society at large.
And, you know, an idea you talk about a lot that is related to this is, you know, what you refer to as genocide by academia.
Yes.
Referring to indigenous populations. I know that ties into this project as well.
It's so crazy because I always talked about like the indigenous cultures in that way. And then I ran into a Facebook page where it was like paper genocide of indigenous people. And I was like, oh my God, it's out there. We are all thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting because some of those girls, for instance, and actually on my father's side, his mtDNA comes from the same group that were written off. And basically it's like, you know, why, you know, like, so I remember speaking to somebody in the Dominican Republic and he was like, oh yeah, you know, my white DNA, even though he was like a very brown Dominican, he was like, oh, my white DNA, which is your direct paternal ancestry, you know, links me to, you know, Bush. So he was like, so like proud of that. Like, and it was, they're European, they're, I say, have you ever done your mtDNA? Because you obviously are either indigenous or you definitely have some African in there. Oh no, I haven't. But to me, that's like, you know, they make fun of you sometimes in the, you know, in the oligarchy in the Dominican Republic, or, you know, oh, why do you want to be so, you know, black or so Haitian or so this or so that or so that? But then they uplift what's white inside of them, but. The white man or the white woman that's living inside of you is as fragmented as the African and as the indigenous. We are a community. We are the springboard of the Americas, the Caribbean, especially Dominican Republic, Santo Domingo, being the first city in the New World as we know it. So we're very, very, very mixed. So if you have African ancestry, European ancestry, whatever, it's all fragmented. Why are we still, despite evidence that more indigenous people are surviving in your DNA than what was previously thought, why are we still going on message and uplifting one side and denouncing the other?
And one final thing, maybe 15 years ago or so, you wrote beautifully about the then new Dr. Dre album, about 2001.
Raquel's review of Dre's 2001 album in The Village Voice, entitled Bitches Brew, said that 2001, quote, is the kind of record that transcendentally raises the bar exam for producers from now until Dre's next joint. Though misogyny reverberates throughout this self-professed family man's juke, let's eulogize the doc's scrupulous other, Andre Young. Mourning the loss of his brother in The Message over a leavening piano loop featuring a bemoaning Mary J. Blige, Dre is introspective without emasculating his borderline stoic image. Meanwhile, members of Dre's stable, Snoop, Eminem, Corrupt, Nate Dogg, Exhibit, constantly maraud space on 2001, leaving little room for Dre to land a perfect 10 in the lexical backflip category.
Have you heard the new one, and what do you think of it?
So far, I have not heard it, because now, every time I, honestly, even back then, it was the same way. But now, I haven't been listening to a lot of hip-hop. So I've been listening to a lot of more salsa, more Cuban, more old-school hip-hop. I do want to listen to it, but I'm just, like, not buying into the whole Straight Outta Compton kind of whitewashing and revisionist telling of their story. Every time I see now, because of its omission, every time I see Dr. Dre or I see Straight Outta Compton, a poster or anything, or I hear about the album, I think of Dee Barnes.
Reasonable thing to think.
You know what I mean?
Like,
it kind of like muddies my, it kind of muddies my thinking even before I listen to it. Even though I have to say, N.W.A., Dr. Dre has made some of the best music. You can't take that. One doesn't nullify the other. He's made some of the best music in hip hop. But now, if I'm listening to anybody from the West Coast, it's usually Kendrick Lamar. I don't know. He just resonates with me. I know he's a protege of Dr. Dre, right?
Yeah. But also has a lot in common with the kind of like freestyle fellowship scene that you were talking about at the very beginning.
Definitely.
Especially on the newest record.
Oh, yeah. He's like a more accessible, palatable version of Freestyle Fellowship, I think.
So we've talked about, you know, your upcoming book, the documentary, anything else you're working on that's up now that you want people to know about?
If you want to listen to me some more.
Another podcast. Yeah, we should tell them in detail.
Yes. Pluggy plug. I'm one of the three main hosts of our national conversation about conversations about race, or simply about race. It's part of the Panoply Network. And, that's been fun so far. And I've been writing, you know, check me out every so often. I contribute pieces to the New York Times travel section. And you see, that's another thing I have to rest with, right? Because it's like, gentrified, you know.
Right.
I believe like a lot of the papers are, you know, obviously the people that are writing, if you read the pieces, they're very much from one, you know, side of the coin, one side of the fence. But I've been really blessed to be able to express myself in a very cool way, in a very different way, as it relates to the New York Times in its travel section.
So yeah, you had your really latest great piece about, you know, a fairly remote,
yeah,
you know, indigenous area at the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's Havasu Falls in the Havasupai Indigenous American Reservation. So yeah, so if you know, I'm there and that's it. Stay up with me, you know what I mean?
All right. Thanks, Adele. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Despite all that Raquel said about the compromises she had to make in order to make Bling happen, the end result is something really special. You see artists actually learning about and engaging with the world in ways that are really open and honest. Like, you see stuff in that movie you don't really see anywhere else. You could tell that the trip and the movie was really affecting because when I talked to Paul Wall about it, even though it had been 7 or 8 years since he'd taken that trip, just the look on his face showed that even now, the experience had affected him so deeply. Also, it's good to know where the Kanye Diamond song actually came from. Please check out Raquel's podcast about race. It's one of the few shows that both Josh and I listen to religiously on the day it's released. One of the ongoing themes of The Cipher has been change and gentrification in New York City. The story of NYC is inextricably linked to hip-hop culture as a whole. To see all of those changes from the point of view of someone as engaged in the conversation around them as Raquel is something I'm very happy to share with you. Join us next week when we will have a return visit from Sky Zoo. Sky was one of our very first guests, and we're thrilled to have him back to discuss his latest album, Music for My Friends, ghostwriting, his close relationship with the recently deceased Sean Price, and much, much more. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe to The Cipher on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or a review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecipher show. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. You can find us everywhere on social media at The Cipher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cipher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
He's so idiotic.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Can I curse?
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
What a fucking douchebag.
Special thanks to our Patreon supporter of the week, Josh Halzak.
Because you're not self-funding.
We'll see you next time around on The Cipher.
Oh, sorry, I'm going to say that again.